Duplicity, this type of deceptive type of behavior. For devotees, we understand that simplicity is always a good quality. Not simplicity, of course, in the sense of being foolish, but simplicity in the sense of being straightforward and honest. One is having some problems. You know, so many people, if they're having some problem, they won't like to show it because it means that people who they feel may have some sort of high impression of them, that those people will see them as being a little silly. So therefore they may try and put on a front of that everything's okay, but it may not be. So in Krishna consciousness, humility is always a very desirable quality. If one is humble, then one will always be able to approach devotees and get help if one needs help. So it's nice to try to avoid these bad tendencies of duplicity, hypocrisy, deceptive behavior. According to Brahmavivarta Purana, in his last life, he was Suhotra, a Gandharva, disciple of Devasamuni, along with his three brothers who became Pralamba and Keshi. He performed austerities at Pushkara Tirtha. Pushkara, that's in Rajasthan on the way, it's past Jaipur, from Delhi, out past Jaipur, on the way to Udaipur. That's the place where there's the only major temple of Lord Brahma in India, Pushkara. So he performed austerities there. Then once, the three brothers, went and picked some lotuses in Chitra Sarovara for offering to Krishna. So you can see they were very nice people, actually. They were devotees. But then they were arrested by some servants of Lord Shiva. Lord Shiva received them very nicely. In fact, he glorified them, actually, that you are great devotees, but told them that he had promised Parvati that he would curse anyone who took lotuses from that lake, as she had vowed to offer 1,000 lotuses a day to Lord Krishna for 100 days. And there were exactly 100,000 lotuses there. And some of those lotuses, the three brothers had now picked. So he was forced by that promise to curse them to appear as demons. But they were then killed by Lord Krishna and liberated. So I'll explain a little bit about the pastime now, mainly from Srimad Bhagavatam, but also with a few other little excerpts from here and there. So this actually takes place earlier on in Krishna's pastimes, quite a bit earlier on. Krishna was still herding the calves. That means he was under 5 years old. So he gathered together with all the cowherd boys, including Balaram, and there was a huge number of calves. Each cowherd boy had his own group of calves. The term that is used, the Sanskrit term, to express the number is asankhyatai. Any of you know what the term Sankhya means? Have any of you heard of this term Sankhya? Who has heard of the term Sankhya? Just a few of you. Yeah, there's a process of yoga called Sankhya Yoga, but Sankhya itself means to enumerate, literally. means to enumerate, to figure out how many things there happen to be of some sort. So Sankhya Yoga means it's a type of yoga where a person enumerates or analyzes and then sort of breaks up the material nature intellectually and sees all the different components separate from the other components. Generally there are 24 components in material nature according to Sankhya Yoga, Sankhya philosophy of Lord Kapila. But here, the term to express the number of calves is asankhyatai, innumerable. Prabhupada says, we may speak of hundreds, thousands, tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands, millions, billions, trillions, tens of trillions, and so on. But when we go further to speak of numbers impossible for us to count, we are speaking of unlimited numbers. Such unlimited numbers are indicated here by the word asankhyatai. That's a statement from Srila Prabhupada. So there's a vast, vast number of calves. This is one of the interesting features of Vrindavan Dham. I don't know if it's been described to you yet, perhaps it has. That Vrindavan Dham in India, where these pastimes are going on as described here, on the surface of it appears to be just some geographic area, not a particularly big geographic area in India. 84 kroshas, 168 square miles, so it's a very finite piece of land in central India. But at the same time we hear that Vrindavan is not different from Goloka Vrindavan in the spiritual world. And of course Goloka Vrindavan in the spiritual world is unlimited, completely unlimited. You can't say, it's like this idea of asankhyatai. You can't say, even if you tried to say, well, maybe it's trillions of square miles. You can't say that. Or at least that doesn't express the size. You can't. It's actually unlimited. But it's all there in this 168 square miles in Vrindavan, here in India. So one thing that happened there, like here we're talking about trillions, tens of trillions and more. I don't think you could fit so many calves in 168 square miles. Tens of trillions is just an absolutely fantastic number. But they were all there, and they would all go together with Krishna and Balaram all over Vrindavan Dham. So that Vrindavan Dham, while Krishna was performing his pastimes, because it is the transcendental realm, then it would expand and contract as Krishna was walking. I'm going to bring that map. I'll bring it next class. I've got this map of Vraja, and we'll point out where some of the places are. So sometimes we hear that, for example, Krishna in the morning, he would start off from Vrindavan village, that's by the Yamuna. It's kind of like south-eastern Vrajmandala. Then they would go to Govardhan Hill, it's about 25 kilometers away. Then, so this is all in the morning, then by late morning they would have gone to Kamyavan. Kamyavan is about another 25 or 30 kilometers. Just little boys with all their calves. And then later in the day, they go all the way back to Vrindavan. So they might walk 60 kilometers or more in a day. And just in a couple of hours, they might cover, no, wait a minute, no, they'd cover 120 kilometers. something like that, in a day. And just in a couple of hours in the morning, they might cover 60 kilometers. So someone, you know, an ordinary person might think, no, 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 this is exaggerated. This is a fairy tale. But the thing is that Vraja expands and contracts to assist Krishna in his pastimes. Actually, as you'll see from this map when we show it, Vraja is in the form of a lotus flower. And lotus flowers, one of their characteristics is that they open and they close every day. They open and then they close. And they open and close like that, day after day. So, when the lotus is open, then from one extreme to the other is quite, I mean, relatively, it's some distance. But when it closes, then those two points which were some distance apart, they come right together. So similarly, to assist Krishna in his pastimes, the lotus of Vraja would open and close. So sometimes he'd walk a long distance, what would apparently be a long distance, but it wasn't. Just took a couple of hours or less. But other times it would expand and it would take a long time to get across. Just like Akrura. We're going to discuss a bit about Akrura later. Akrura came from Mathura to Nandagram. That means probably it's about 50 kilometers. Or perhaps not that long. It's probably more like about 30 kilometers. But it took him a long time on a chariot. It took him the whole day. He started early in the morning. He only got there right in the evening, so perhaps 12 hours. So why should it take such a long time? The reason is that the lotus of Vraja expanded, so it took him a longer time to cover that distance. So these things are happening in Vrindavan. So they were Krishna, Balaram, the cow boys. They took this vast number of calves and they were moving around in Vraja. Then again, as we heard yesterday in regard to Kaliya, they all felt thirsty. So they went to a reservoir of water. But what should they see? But a gigantic form resembling a mountain peak broken and struck down by a thunderbolt. In other words, this form looked rather strange in different ways. Looked like it was smashed, that's one thing, it was very big. We'll discuss in a little while why it looked smashed. But this was Bakasura. Bakasura, great mystic Asura, who transformed himself into the body, into the form of a bird. Prabhupada says a duck, but it's more like a stork or a crane, that type of bird with a very sharp pointed beak. So Bakasura, he wanted to avenge the killing of his sister, Putana. So he immediately came and attacked Krishna. Of course, Bakasura actually is a human being, but he's a great mystic. So therefore he can assume these forms as he likes. So he assumed that form. And he came and immediately swallowed Krishna. So, as he swallowed Krishna, Lord Balaram, all the coward boys were looking on, and even Lord Balaram became stunned out of affection under the influence of Yoga Maya. And he became sort of immobilized. He didn't really know what to do. And Bakasura was trying to swallow Krishna. But as he was swallowing Krishna, suddenly he found that Krishna tasted terrible. In fact, Krishna was tasting so horrible that not just tasting horrible, but burning hot. That Bhagasura then, he was forced to just spit him out. And he just, it was like a very unpleasant experience for him. So he experienced the burning sensation because from Krishna's body emanates the Brahma Jyoti. And the Brahma Jyoti is like a transcendental light energy. So it also has transcendental heat. So Bhakasura's throat got burnt by Krishna. Then on top of that, because Bhakasura is a demon, a real demon, and he hates Krishna, therefore he tastes Krishna's body as if it's bitter or sour, so a very unpleasant taste. Now, very interesting thing about Krishna is that Krishna's body is sweet. One devotee once, there's one poem, goes something like, sweet, sweet, can't beat the treat of your lotus feet. Something like that. So Krishna's lotus feet, Krishna's whole body, they're sweet. Now, if, you know, if you sort of suck your own body or lick your own body or someone else's body, you probably just get the perspiration and not very sweet. But Krishna's body is sweet. So sweet that Krishna's body is overwhelmingly fragrant. Just astonishingly fragrant. In fact, this is one of the fairly significant problems in the pastimes of Radha and Krishna when it comes to their attempts to avoid Jatila and Kutila, Radharani's mother-in-law and sister-in-law. They're always on the lookout. Our Radha and Krishna associating, we must stop them somehow, we have to keep track of them, watch them, like that. So, Radha and Krishna, though, of course, they're always able to foil their attempts and they're able to meet. But then Jatila and Kutila, by the arrangement of Purnamasi, as we were discussing, I think, yesterday, they manage to find Radha and Krishna. But generally, Radha and Krishna, they get alerted because they have their lookouts. Some of the younger gopi girls, they're always on guard. So they come running in and say, ah, Jatila's just around the corner. So immediately Krishna will jump up and run. But because his body is so fragrant, this beautiful aroma remains there in the area. So Jatila comes running in, and there's Radharani on her own. And Jatila says, ah, Krishna's been here, I know. And Radharani says, no, where's Krishna? He's not here. But Jatila says, no, I know. I can smell the smell of his body. So this makes it difficult for Radha and Krishna. But the fact is that Krishna's body is so fragrant, so tasty. Krishna's body is so tasty that you may know in Srimad Bhagavatam it's described how Markandeya Rishi, he wanted to experience what it was like to live through a universal devastation. So he was in the middle of the waters of devastation. It was just a wild situation, these huge waves crashing on him, and eventually got thrown up on an island, which was Navadweep, which is never destroyed. So he was sitting there on the beach, wondering why he ever desired to go through a devastation. And what should he see? But I think it was one little leaf, or one big leaf, with one little, beautiful little boy lying down, little baby boy lying down on this leaf. And this little boy was sucking one of his big toes. It's described in the Bhagavatam. There's a picture there. Very nice picture. And it was Krishna. he was sucking his one of his big toes. And Markandeya asked him, why are you sucking your toe? He said, well, you know, there's so many people, great devotees, and they keep talking about how my lotus feet are so sweet, and I wanted to see what they're really like myself, so now I'm sucking my toes, and actually they are nice. So Krishna, his body, everything about him is transcendentally sweet. His body is sweet. His qualities are sweet. His personality is sweet. His pastimes are sweet. The discussions of his pastimes are sweet. Hearing about him, chanting about him. His name is sweet. Why is Krishna's name sweet? Why is it that Rupa Goswami said that when I chant the name Krishna, I wish that I had millions of tongues to taste the sweetness, and I wish I had millions of ears to hear that sweet sound. Why? Because that holy name is Krishna, and Krishna is sweet. So one is literally tasting the sweetness of Krishna himself. But if you're a demon, then you don't find Krishna's name very sweet. That's why in Chaitanya Charitamrita it's described that Prabodhananda Saraswati, was it? No, Prakashananda. Prakashananda Saraswati, big Mayavadi. When he met Lord Chaitanya, he tried to ask him, why do you chant the name Krishna? But he couldn't say it. He said, why do you chant the name Krishna? He couldn't say it. But he said to him, you're Chaitanya, aren't you? And Lord Chaitanya said, yes. So he couldn't chant the name Krishna because he was a demon. But the name Chaitanya, even though he was a demon, he could chant that name. Because Lord Chaitanya is so merciful that even if you're a big offender like Prakashananda Saraswati, but still, even though you can't chant the name Krishna, but still, by Lord Chaitanya's mercy, you can chant his name. So, just like it's described in, Rupa Goswami describes in Upadeshamrita, Nectar of Instruction, that when a person is materially diseased, when they're in the material condition, this is like a diseased condition, he compares it to the disease of jaundice. When you get jaundice, then things which are sweet taste very bitter. Somehow that disease affects your sense of taste. So you can eat sugar, just pure sugar, it'll taste bitter, very unpleasant. And not only that, but you see things yellow. So your sense of taste and your sense of sight become quite severely affected by the disease. So we're in a diseased condition from the spiritual point of view. So we are perceiving things incorrectly. Just like the person with jaundice, he's perceiving the sugar to be bitter. That's incorrect. It's not bitter. So similarly, we are perceiving, spiritually perceiving things incorrectly. And that which is sweet, we may taste to be bitter. Of course, you're all great devotees, so I know you like chanting Hare Krishna, but the people in general, so many people, they may wonder, why are you chanting this Hare Krishna? It's nonsense. Why not chant something else? Why not chant anything? Chant Krishna, chant Coca-Cola, chant your mother's name. Chant anything. Why would you get any more from chanting Krishna than you do from chanting some other sound vibration? They would think like that. And so many people, like when we go out on Harinam, we try and get people to chant. Everyone put your hands in the air and everyone chant Hare Krishna. I know you've all done it before. And some may do it, but some they just stand there. Because they don't have that taste. Otherwise they'd immediately scream, Hare Krishna, in great ecstasy. But they're not tasting it like that. They taste it to be bitter. So it's a diseased condition. This is why, you know, like when you begin chanting, I remember when I began chanting, the devotees gave me a set of japa beads and said, here, take these and chant 16 rounds. So I said, I saw the other devotees doing it, so I thought, oh, well, okay, why not? So I started chanting. By the time I got to 2 rounds, I was thinking, gosh, how am I meant to do 16? This is ridiculous. Fortunately, after a few days, I got the hang of it, but it's like that. So Bakasura, we're talking about Bakasura, he swallowed the body of Krishna. Now that body is not different from the name. That body is there in the name. When you chant, Hare Krishna, Krishna's there on your tongue. The same Krishna that Bakasura was trying to swallow. So Bakasura, because he's a demon, he found Krishna to taste very unpleasant. So he spat him out. So, actually it describes, Krishna's whole body is sweeter than sugar candy. But Bakasura tasted bitterness. And Prabhupada quotes chapter 4, verse 11 of Bhagavad Gita, Ye yatamam prabhajante. If you accept Krishna to be an enemy, he'll relate with you like that. If you accept him as your friend, he'll relate with you like that. As you approach him, he'll reciprocate. So this is shown by the example of Bakasura. So Krishna now is back out of Bakasura's mouth. So with his arms, Krishna, with both hands, he captured the two halves of the beak of Bakasura and started opening his mouth. So he opened his mouth up. Prabhupada uses the term that he bifurcated him. He actually split his head open by opening his beak up wider and wider and wider. The Bhagavatam says, very easily Krishna did that. As easily as a child splits a blade of grass. So then Bakasura was dead. Now, we mentioned earlier that when Bakasura came on the scene, Bhagavatam mentions actually, he looked like the peak of a mountain which had been smashed by a thunderbolt and knocked off down to the ground. In other words, he looked really like shaken up, like he'd really undergone a traumatic experience. Sure, it's not very nice being hit by a thunderbolt. So why? Oh, we get a little information about this from Garga Samhita. I'll just read it. As Bakasura came to attack Krishna and the cowherd boys, the demigods tried to attack him, to intercept him. So Indra threw his thunderbolt and knocked Bakasura to the ground, but he got up again. Brahma hit him with his Brahma Danda, one stick that Brahma carries. He carries his Brahma Danda, it's like a smallish type of stick, plus a water pot. So Brahma hit him with his Brahma Danda and knocked him unconscious for one muhurta. 48 minutes, it's one muhurta. But then he got up again. Then Shiva came and hurled his trident at him and cut off one of his wings, but the demon recovered. Vayu came and hurled his wind weapon at him, but Baka, even with just one wing, flew out of the way. Lord Yamaraj came and struck him with his Yamadanda. That's the stick that he carries for inflicting or like judging the conditioned souls. But when he struck Bakasura with his Yamadanda, the dunder broke. Then Surya attacked, Surya's the sun god, attacked Baka with 100 arrows, but he still did not die. Then Kuvera came and struck him with his sword and cut off the other wing, but he still did not die. Then Soma, he's another demigod, heavenly denizen, Soma attacked him with an ice weapon.